Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of January. Happy New Year to you, and thanks to John Munson for doing a fine job hosting this program while I was spending the holidays with my family. It was good. It's always strange to come back the first day of work, though, isn't it? You feel, can I talk? I've been reading and eating. Can I talk? Well, there's a lot to talk about the first hour of our program. Professor Marvin Overby will be with us. He is chair of the department and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri. The president is going to be talking this afternoon about new measures to beef up airline security. We'll be talking about what would make us safe. We'll also be looking at jobs in the new year. Bob Herbert, an interesting column today in which he said that the current state of decline in this country is bound to continue. You can't have a healthy economy with so many millions of people out of work, and there is no plan now that would result in the creation of millions of new jobs anytime soon. Healthcare reform. There is now a plan to skip the formal conference committee and negotiate informally on respective healthcare bills in the Senate and in the House. We'll be talking about that. Are there problems in trying to come up with a reconciliation of these bills and what will emerge from that and when will it emerge? We'll be talking about that and a number of other issues. I want to tell you that you are welcome to join the conversation anytime. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email is up and running. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for your contributions to the program today. Our guest, Professor Marvin Overby. Professor Overby, thank you very much for being with us, and Happy New Year to you.
It's my pleasure, and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. I understand it's mighty cold in Missouri today.
Yes, ma'am. I think it just got about zero here.
Oh, no. And you're not used to that.
We are not as used to it as you guys are.
Yeah, that is cold. Let's start with airline safety. I was amazed to read that there are 550,000 suspected terrorists. That's a lot of people, isn't it? I wonder how many of those are on no-fly lists or watch lists, or I would imagine all of those people are being investigated pretty thoroughly this week.
Well, you know, Kathleen, I'm not sure about that. I mean, 500,000 or more, these are people on some sort of watch list. It's unclear sort of what evidence there is against any of these people or really how carefully they're being watched. You know, there's an old saying in the intelligence communities that if you make everything top secret, nothing is top secret. Mm. There's sort of an analogy here that if you make so many people subject to these sort of special screenings and some sort of special sort of scrutiny that in fact you're likely to miss the important threats.
Mm-hmm. The president is going to be announcing some new airline security measures this afternoon. Where do you think he's heading?
Well, I'm not sure anyone is certain about that. He seems to be taking his time on this, seems to be giving it sort of consideration. I suspect we're not going to see anything too drastic, in part because, you know, nothing truly catastrophic happened here. I think there has been sort of a desire on the part of especially Republicans to try to heighten this, to try to make it more of an issue than it really was. And I think I'm going to give the president some credit here to sort of stepping back, taking a deep breath, and trying to let this cool down a bit, not overreacting to the situation.
Mm-hmm. Did you see the story last night? It was just a little bit of a story. I was watching NBC News in which they said, I think the Times this coming Sunday magazine section is going to have a story about the threat of bombs going off on Inauguration Day, that there were, I don't know the details, but that there were people who were attempting to carry bombs from Somalia from Canada into the United States.
Oh, I had not heard that, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I think we tend in the United States to focus on airline security, but it may well be the case that the real threats out there have nothing to do with airline travel, and they're going to be aimed at what are now much softer targets, other forms of transportation, you know, this massive security apparently this year at the Rose Bowl. I think people were told to get there 4 hours earlier. You know, airports now are relatively hardened. It's going to be difficult to get the kind of explosive power onto an airplane that would be required to bring it down or to take control over it. But there are many, many other softer targets out there that I think are probably, you know, much more susceptible to this sort of activity.
Mm-hmm. And there is talk that the agencies weren't talking to each other, reminiscent of 9/11 in a way that somebody didn't talk to somebody else to say that this guy's father had been to the embassy to say my son is not a good guy. Is there a problem, do you think, with these agencies speaking with one another?
Well, it depends what you sort of define as a problem there. Agencies certainly have difficulties communicating with each other. They have different agendas. They have different operating assumptions. They have different cultures. There's a good deal of systemic rivalry between different agencies. There's a lot of political bargaining and politics at stake in these sorts of arrangements. So the agencies have difficulties sort of meshing with each other. But again, part of the problem may be here that there's simply that we're trying to cast the net too widely. If you've got 500,000 people, and I've seen sources saying, you know, as many as 1,600 new people being added to these various watch lists per day, that's going to strain even very well integrated communication structures between agencies.
Right. Let's move to, and I'm sure that our listeners will take us back to this, but let's move to healthcare, which we've been talking about for a long time now. Recent news that the House and Senate Democrats will bypass traditional procedures when they negotiate the final compromise on healthcare legislation. So they're excluding Republican lawmakers, which would reduce their ability to delay votes on this. Is this unusual for them to do this, and why would they choose this route, and how significant is it?
Well, answering those questions requires a little bit of background on the House versus the Senate. As you know, Kathleen, the Senate is an institution where individual senators and certainly the minority party or minority interests have a great deal of sway. The fact that the Senate does not have a standing germaneness rule that limits debate, and the fact the Senate doesn't have a previous question, which would cut off debate with a majority vote, means that the senators can and do filibuster measures to try to either change them or derail them. And that, I think, is what we're seeing here. Efforts to move toward a conference committee can be filibustered as many as three different times because of the way the Senate rules are written. And we've seen this. Republicans began developing this tool back when they were in the minority in the early 1990s, trying to block campaign finance reform. They can block the calling of a conference. They can block the naming of conferees by a filibuster. All of that could potentially either block a conference from ever happening or certainly delay it for weeks or even months into the new year. And I think what we're seeing is the Democrats want to try to avoid that. They want to try to accomplish reconciling the House and Senate versions of the bill through a process of amendment between the House, is sometimes called the ping-pong maneuver. And we'll see later this week, I think the House Democratic Conference is meeting on Thursday to try to decide if this is the route they want to pursue.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at the major differences between what the Senate has passed and what the House has passed, does it go way beyond public option?
It does. I mean, there are five or six other differences between the bills, ranging from differences regarding whether abortion can be covered under the new healthcare system. The cost is significantly higher estimated on the House version. The funding mechanisms are different between the two versions. The penalties are different between the two versions. The coverage of immigrants is different between the two versions. And I think affordability is different between the two versions. These differences are in many cases not huge, but they're the kind of thing that's going to have to be ironed out and reconciled in some way. It is, I think, important to provide a little bit of other context here. Most bills do not go through conference committee. You know, most of the legislation that's passed by the House and the Senate is ironed out either by one side acceding to the version passed by the other, or by this amendment process back and forth between the chambers. Major bills are more likely to go through conference committee, but it's not at all unusual for bills to bypass conference.
Mm. So is there still a possibility that the House could say, we accept the Senate bill?
I think so. so, although, again, we're going to remains to be seen. The Democratic majority in the House and the Democratic majority in the Senate are roughly the same size, 58% in the House and 60% in the Senate. But that 40% Republican minority in the Senate can do a lot more to stop bills than the 40% Republican majority in the House. And House Democrats have to be cognizant of that. They have to come up with a reconciled version of the bill that is going to be able to get at least 60 votes in the Senate.
Did you expect that there would be, well, I guess there was one Republican vote in the House on this. Did you expect that it would be as partisan as it is?
You know, Kathleen, I've been trying to sort that out in my mind, and I've come to the following conclusion, which I'm not sure how wedded I am to it, but I'll put it forward for people to discuss. And that is that Republicans may know that their best chance is defeating this bill entirely, right? That they don't want this measure to ever, any sort of measure to ever become public policy. Because history has shown that when these sort of health care reforms are put into place, the public actually grows to rather fond of them, rather attached to them. And so for all of the Republican rhetoric on the right saying that the public doesn't like this, the public will revolt against this, I think they know that's unlikely to be the case, and that their best political bet is not to let the Democrats pass a bill that's unpopular with the public, because that's not going to happen, I don't think, but to try to prevent any sort of measure being passed so they can paint the White House and the Democratic majorities in the Congress as being incompetent to craft legislation, even when they have these large majorities.
Oh, that's interesting. And what about the public? What do we want?
Oh boy, that's a tough question. I sometimes tell my students that we want Michelob Light. We want a beer that tastes great and is less filling at the same time. And we see that a lot in terms of the politics that goes on. We want more services and we want lower taxes. We want this and not this at the same time, and that is why you see sort of these competing polls and you see the public sort of swaying on this, large majorities voting for change in 2008, but then large majorities telling pollsters they don't want this sort of change in 2009 and 2010. So I think the public in general wants peace and prosperity, but on particular matters of policy, they can be relatively easily swayed by rhetoric coming from either side.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. We have yet to talk about, a number of other issues. I want to look at the issue of jobs in this new year. It seems as though economic improvement is something that is mandatory for the administration to gain higher approval ratings than they have right now, and other issues. We can go back, certainly, to airport security and airline security, which is very much an issue of this year, this week. We've talked about healthcare reform, and I thought that our guest had some interesting things to say about that the Republicans really don't want a bill that might indeed, because a lot of bills previously that have dealt with health care reform have become popular, so they don't want that to happen. That's an interesting take on this, which I haven't heard before. What do you think? Our guest is Professor Marvin Overby. He is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maryland. And we're welcoming your phone calls as we talk about the issues that Congress is facing and the president is facing as we begin a whole new year. Here's the phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, and we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like to do that. The address there is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Just a programming note, tomorrow during this hour, Alan Alda will be with us. He's going to be talking about his hosting a three-part series, The Human Spark, that looks at what makes us human. And he's a guy he's just a totally delightful person and has this wonderful curiosity about science. So he's going to be with us during our 9 o'clock hour tomorrow to talk about this series and science. To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Second hour of our program today, we'll talk with an environmental law and policy expert about how urban planters are rethinking the typical American city and making them greener. Okay, to your phone calls now. Steve from Houston is our first caller. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi there. You know, I work in the business world, and, you know, quite frankly, I don't mean this personally, but I'm so tired of listening to liberal academics mischaracterize Republican opposition to, you know, the massive growth of big government, you know, by saying that your example was you said that Republicans are afraid that people are going to get comfortable with the fact that the federal government is going to run the healthcare system. Well, that's real simplistic. But, you know, people got real comfortable with welfare. But if you look at the black community, and that was my area of study, and, you know, it's almost destroyed the initiative of people, you know, to work. Governor Thompson came into Wisconsin when I used to live there, and he reformed it, and he required people to take responsibility for their lives. And yet a lot of people testified, and that was the best thing that ever happened. So with this medical system being taken over by the government, you're going to make a lot of people very comfortable with that. But in the long run, you know, if you look at Medicare and Medicaid, they're almost bankrupt. And now, you know, the fact that the Democrats are ramming this through without giving the Republicans who represent businesses which employ and pay people, you know, giving them any input in this is a scam, because the reality is that this is going to be bankrupt. Our government's going to be bankrupt. And then what are we going to do? You know, states like Texas, Governor Perry had the sense to say, we're not taking a penny from the Obama administration's mandate, because with it comes the requirement that you continue policies that now a lot of states are realizing that they can't afford. I mean, the whole thing is a scam. And I really wish Wisconsin Public Radio would give the conservative voice in the business community a chance to speak their piece, because this whole thing is a joke. The whole debate on this issue, you know, I don't mean this personally, but with Wisconsin Public Radio and the mainstream press, is a joke. You know, liberal academics only represent the Democratic Party. Why don't you give businesses a chance to speak about who's going to pay for this, and what this is going to do to small businesses?
All right. Well, I think we just did. That's we're hearing your opinion on this, Steve. Professor Overby.
I don't know who Steve is talking about. I don't consider myself a liberal academic at all. I'm an academic, but I'm a reasonably moderate in my political views. I was simply pointing out the political reality, right, which is that these programs, once they are passed, become relatively popular with the public. And that is the political reality, I think, that the Republicans are having to deal with. Whether or not health care reform is a good idea in some sort of universal sense, that's something I think people of goodwill can disagree about. But I think that it is a largely incontrovertible fact that these programs do, in fact, gain a lot of public support once they're passed. And therefore, the Republicans, I believe, know that their best political bet here is to keep it from being passed, that the public is not going to rear up against these things, against these reforms once they're in place. They're going to like the fact that their kids can stay on their health care till they're 26. They're going to like many aspects of these proposed reforms. And that is going to, when it happens, I think, is going to rebound against the Republican Party. And I'm not trying to make any sort of ideological point there. I'm simply making a point about political reality as I understand it.
What's interesting here is that Steve used the phrase this government takeover, but the bill that's going to emerge here, much to the chagrin of progressives, is that there's not enough of a government option.
Well, that's exactly right, Kathleen, and it is a bill that has been crafted by the American political system, which in fact does not like radical changes. It's a system that is not comfortable with making the kind of massive sweeping changes that some people on the left would like to see on some occasions, and some people on the right would like to see on other occasions. It is a process that hammers out compromises between, again, people of goodwill who have differences of opinions about what the role of government should be. And that's why you're seeing you're likely to see a bill emerge at the end of this that satisfies neither the deans of the world nor the Michael Steeles of the world, neither the Republican right nor the Democratic left.
Thanks, Steve, very much for your call. Let's go to Richard next from Jackson. Hi, Richard.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm sorry to go away from healthcare, but the professor mentioned earlier that there was no germane policy currently in effect, and I believe House rules and Senate rules both have germane policies. However, they require that they invoke it themselves, and they choose not to do that. Is that correct?
Not exactly. The House of Representatives operates under a standing germaneness rule, which means that when a bill comes up for debate on the floor, both the comments that are made about the bill and any amendments to the bill have to be germane to the bill itself. In the Senate, and that is implemented through the Rules Committee of the House of Representatives, which proposes a rule that is then passed by majority vote on the floor of the House of Representatives. In the Senate does not have a standing germaneness requirement, which means that senators have much greater latitude about what they talk about on the floor of the Senate and what they can propose in terms of amendments. There's no standing requirement in the Senate that an amendment offered to a bill has to be germane to the underlying purpose of the bill, and there's no requirement that what you say on the floor of the Senate is relevant to the bill itself. That's why you can have filibusters where senators stand up and read names from the phone book or their grandmother's favorite recipes or whatever. The Senate can, in fact, invoke certain germaneness requirements, but that requires what's called a unanimous consent agreement, a UCA. And a UCA is, as its title suggests, something that has to be unanimous, right? It has to have the support of all 100 senators. And, of course, that is relatively difficult to get.
Yeah, I would say so. Thanks very much for the call. Mike from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. What, in your opinion, why is it that so many people, you said a list of 500,000 or more, think we're so despicable that they have to go to a foreign country, become indoctrinated, and then come back and be willing to commit suicide? I mean, that takes a lot of nerve. And the problem, as I'm wondering, is why is this? Why are there so many people that dislike us?
That's a question better placed to a psychologist than it is to me. I don't have any particular insights into that, other than that there is a widespread discontent, especially in the Muslim world, with American foreign policy that goes back for decades, and is in some sense centered on our support for the creation of the State of Israel and support of the State of Israel we've given over the decades. It has to do with rabid dislike of the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia, the home of Mecca and Medina. It has to do with a feeling of dispossession and rage among certain elements of Muslim society at what they see as their inability to deal effectively with the West militarily in terms of conventional or either conventional warfare or conventional diplomacy. And we've seen, as a result of that, this sort of burgeoning of a generation of young Muslims, particularly, who are willing to go to extreme measures. Beyond that, I'm not sure I've got the expertise to say much more.
Did you see something new here? A lot was made of this double agent, Al-Qaeda double agent, who was responsible for killing the CIA officers in Afghanistan. Is Al-Qaeda going to a new level of sophistication here with that kind of attack?
I don't know. I rather suspect not. The United States has broad exposure in the world, and it's going to be very, very difficult for us to be 100% successful at protecting everyone we have out there, every plane that's in the air, every operative, every soldier, every civilian employee, every embassy employee. I don't necessarily think that these sort of isolated incidents, some of which are effective from Al-Qaeda's perspective in terms of killing CIA operatives, and some of which are utter failures, such as the recent attempt to take down an airliner. I don't think they necessarily tell us much in isolation about sort of the operational abilities of Al-Qaeda at this point.
We go back to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Darlene is next. Hello, Darlene.
Hi.
Hi.
Morning. Sorry I have laryngitis today, but I'm going to go back to the health care bill.
All right.
Has there been any discussion about the abortion part of it, that because people are so divided on this issue that they could, on their tax returns, check, you know, how much they want to donate money, some of their money to it, so there'd be a big pool of it. And if not much money comes in, it'll be very much understood that people don't want to fund that, because I certainly don't want any of my money going to abortion.
Professor Overby, how is that being dealt with? It hasn't yet, really, in this.
It hasn't. There are differences between the House and the Senate versions. The House version, as I understand it, bans any federal funding that goes through any sort of health care reforms for funding abortion. The Senate version allows it. But the caller does raise sort of an interesting question. If you look at many of the other differences between the House and the Senate version, they are essentially numerical differences, where there could be some sort of movement between the House version is estimated to cost $1 trillion, the Senate version $171 billion. You could see some sort of movement towards some middle ground there. But when it comes to matters that touch on abortion, there's very little middle ground that the two opposing ends of the spectrum can agree on. I think the American public generally has a relatively moderate attitude regarding abortion, and sort of Bill Clinton was able to sort of encapsulate that for a while, that we want abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. But the extremes on both sides, the pro-life side on one end and the national abortion rights activists on the other end, they see sort of any movement toward the center as a violation of principle, and principles are very hard to resolve.
Thanks, Darlene, so much for your call. I want to talk a little bit about jobs. I was interested in Bob Herbert's column this morning, in which he said that we have a state of decline going on in America right now, that we cannot have a healthy economy with so many millions of people out of work, and that there is no plan now that would result in the creation of millions of new jobs anytime soon. Does that need to be on this administration's agenda sometime this year?
Kathleen, I think very much so, and I think that's one of the reasons why the White House is likely going to be putting pressure on the Democratic delegations in both the House and the Senate to move relatively quickly on health care, and that's probably one of the reasons why they do not want a prolonged, potentially filibustered fight over the naming of conferees and the establishment of a conference, is that they want health care to be resolved one way or the other within the next couple of weeks as opposed to the next couple of months. And that would then let the administration pivot to begin to address the job issue more. Because I think unemployment at the end of the day is going to be much more of an important factor in sort of determining sort of what the dynamics of the midterm elections are going to look like. If unemployment remains high, above 12% in California, above 10% nationally, Democrats are looking at taking some pretty massive hits potentially in the midterm elections. So the administration is banking on some good luck, that the natural sort of business cycle is going to pick up. We're going to see employment picking up, and that they can get some good luck in terms of sort of the public perceptions of this, of them doing something about the matter.
Mm-hmm. And what about health care being done in a couple weeks? Is that realistic?
I don't know. It probably is, but it's going to depend upon sort of the ability of the House and the Senate to come to an agreement about whether or not they're going to go to conference, if they can bypass conference, and I think the House members are going to have to swallow more of the Senate version. If that comes to pass, if Speaker Pelosi and the Democratic leadership in the House can essentially push through acceptance of the Senate version, I think we're likely to see this resolve relatively quickly.
We go to Michael from Milwaukee. Hello, Michael.
Morning.
Hi.
You touched on jobs, and I think that's a very important thing looking down into our future here. Everybody says we need more jobs, but I don't hear anybody talking about the fact that if we don't quit buying things made in China and if all our manufacturing is done in China, these jobs are never going to happen. One of the things that, well, I read in today's paper where the city of Milwaukee is going to get the police uniforms made in China, actually spending more money to get made in China uniforms than they could purchase the uniforms made in the United States. This is the same city that's complaining that it needs work for its citizens. I don't know why these people can't put two and two together. Another thing is we've been very lucky, because if you look at this insanity with this security in the airports and stuff like this, this has been a relief valve for people, getting jobs in the security industry. If it wasn't for that, also people getting jobs in the military because of the wars that we're fighting. But when this gets all straightened out, we're going to have manufacturing jobs. I never hear this addressed, other than people saying we can't afford to make things here because it costs too much. But there's other costs. We live in a country that takes care of its people that don't have jobs. So if you don't provide people with jobs, even if it costs more to make a product here, you're paying them to sit home and do nothing.
Hmm.
So that's all I've got.
Thanks, Michael. Good points. Professor?
I'm not sure exactly how I want to respond to that, other than to notice that different societies, different economies have different comparative advantages in what they can produce. The Chinese are going to be better at producing some things than we are. And American consumers have shown over the past several decades a willingness to embrace that. You can make textiles much cheaper in places like China than you can in the United States. I think I'm not in favor of the kind of protectionism that would protect non-competitive American jobs from international competition. What we need to do, instead of thinking about how to bring manufacturing, sort of old industry jobs back to the United States, is to begin thinking about where the growth is going to be in the sectors of the economy where we have a comparative advantage in terms of the education of our workforce, in terms of the standard of living of our workforce, in terms of the value added of our workforce. We can and do outproduce countries like China in many of those areas. And what we need to do, I think, is focus on growing those sectors of the economy, because that's where real economic growth is going to be, and that's where real jobs are going to be. And I think, we tend to focus on China. When we think about China at all, we tend to portray it as some sort of huge menace out there. China has plenty of its own problems to deal with, and we're going to see the Chinese economy is probably not nearly as strong in reality as it looks to us from a distance. I think the Chinese government has been manipulating a number of the statistics that make their growth rate and their productivity look much higher than it really is. And they have huge problems coming in terms of things like a population bubble that dwarfs the baby boom bubble here. So I think we make a mistake when we focus on sort of trying to compete with China on these measures. We're not going to compete with China in production of some goods, and we're going to far outstrip them in the production of others. And the secret is concentrating on those where we have that natural comparative advantage.
And let's go a little bit further with his other point, Professor Overby. What does it mean in terms of our economic stability or our economic future to be devoting a significant amount of our resources on security, probably growing resources on security as a result of the attempted bombing on Christmas, and on war?
I've got concerns about that, Kathleen, and it's not just security, it's not just war, it's also the prison complex in the United States. Mm. I mean, a huge growth sector in the economy has been based upon the incarceration we have the second highest incarceration rate in recorded history after Nazi Germany. And these tend to be relatively non-productive segments of the economy. They are not producing goods and services that we are going to consume and it's going to make our lives appreciably better. So sort of a focus on trying to create jobs in these areas, a focus on prisons, a focus on the military, which is a highly inflationary sector, a focus on sort of the security efforts, an overreaction in terms of security, in my opinion, I think is not good for the economy.
We go next to Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Fine guest. We need a solar thermal Stirling engine production facility in Detroit for all of those workers. But that isn't what I called it to talk about. There were two really interesting paired editorials in this morning's New York Times, one by Brooks on the teabag movement, which is apparently more popular than either of the two major parties. And the other was Hebert's article on massive unemployment and the dysfunction in the American economy. And I was wondering if we're approaching a situation where we might have an insurgent third-party movement where the political class and topics of discussion are shifted, as Perot did for dealing with the deficit. And I'm wondering, would there be a fracture in the medium term, either amongst the Republicans, if this is possible, or amongst the Democrats? Or would there be a larger third-party movement that would shift the entire discussion in whether or not we have a two-party system? Because if Perot merely changed the topic, but of course his party was a no-go. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank. Bye.
Kathleen, every generation, it seems like, has this argument about whether there is going to be a new third party emerge. The Dixiecrats in the 1940s, the Perot movement in the 1990s, and we've had other examples in American history before that. But the American system and the American public is simply not amenable, I think, to the emergence of competitive third parties. For all the strum and drang about, you know, particular issues and particular matters that come up, the American public is relatively moderate in its viewpoints. We talk about American public opinion being moderate and unimodal, which means most people are more or less in the center. And we have a constitutional system that is essentially first past the post. We elect one officer for every office. And that tends to create a situation, those two things in combination tend to create a situation in which there is not much room for third parties, for minor parties to emerge. And there is no reward in the short term for the organization of a third party because you're only competing for essentially one prize. And we've known for a long time something called Duverger's Law, that the electoral system like that, where you have this first-past-the-post constitutional arrangement, is going to tend to yield two major parties and is going to make it very, very, very difficult for a third party to emerge. So I think this is something we go through periodically. We wring our hands about the declining relevance of the two major parties. We see evidence that there is some sort of group popping up either on the left or the right. But in the long view of history, these things don't tend to last, and they don't tend to matter all that much, except to the extent that one of the major parties begins to co-opt part of the policies being advocated by these new groups.
And we'll welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour, Professor Marvin Overby, he is chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri. We're talking about a variety of issues, third parties, unemployment, the threat of terror and whether or not we are overreacting to it, healthcare reform, et cetera. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, and use the email. Why not? Talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program. This Tuesday, we will be speaking with the director of the Midwest Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, looking at what it is we can do to make cities green places and what it is that Chicago particularly has done to accomplish that. Okay, back to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Randy's been waiting a while from Key Wascom. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, back to health care. Basically, yeah, that they don't have a strong public option. This is just meant they're going to blow up the system so they can move in and take over. I guess when you got a guest that doesn't have to worry about it because he's exempt from the changes, just like the senators and congressmen are. In the case of our Senator Feingold, he doesn't even listen to the public anymore. Well, he hasn't for years. I tried for 6 years to find out when his Washington County listening sessions are. He doesn't let me know. He doesn't put it on his website. He just had a listening session in Mequon where people came in and were just irate about this piece of crap bill.
And he
just blew them off.
Randy, what's your concern?
What's my concern? Basically, this health care bill has nothing to do with fixing health care. It has to do with taking it over. It's blowing up the system so they can take it over. And that'll just give them more strength in Washington. Basically, it's moving power away from the people and into Washington. As far as jobs, it will destroy jobs, so unemployment will go up. That'll help them because, well, here, we'll give you something free. Let's get people on the dole so that, if we're giving them enough, they'll vote for us so they don't get rid of the handouts. I'm self-employed. I've been paying my own health insurance my whole life. I work a 90-hour work week, and I worked 360 days last year. Basically, what's going to happen here, this health care bill will make me trim an employee, and I'll be working 100 hours a week.
All right. Professor Overby?
I'm not sure exactly how to respond to that other than to note that there is a great deal of anger about that, about these measures out in the general public. But I think that the anger is generally unfocused. I'm not sure there is anything in this relatively moderate, modest bill that's going to be likely be passed by the House and the Senate that's going to have the kind of catastrophic consequences that the caller anticipates. But his unfocused anger does point out that there is sort of in the American psyche, in American history, and in sort of the American public dialogue, this real distrust of government. And we distrust government, we dislike government, we call it them when it really is us. We don't want the federal government doing things until we have some need for them, and then we expect the federal government to step in and take care of the natural disaster or take care of the threat to security or take care of the whatever problem emerges. And I'm just not sure that this sort of unfocused anger about government helps us deal in any sort of realistic way with the problems the country faces.
Yeah. And what about health care reform as it now stands, or the components of both the Senate and the House bill? Will they help people, do you think, in Randy's situation that he's self-employed and paying his own health insurance, I would imagine? Is there something to help out people like Randy, do you think?
Well, of course, because people like Randy are voters, right? And the members of Congress and the president are concerned about what voters are going to have to put up with. And there are going to be aspects of whatever sort of reform is eventually passed that is going to make it more palatable for the public. It's going to provide support for small businesses that are going to be adversely hurt by this. But it's also, if you believe in the basic premise of healthcare reform, that it is better to deal with healthcare problems before they become chronic, that it's better to deal with healthcare matters before people show up at the emergency room when the cost of healthcare then just skyrockets. This can indeed save the entire healthcare economy a good deal of money, and that will, of course, eventually could result in helping all of us. So when the caller suggests that I don't have a stake in this, or that other members of Congress don't have a stake in this, I think that's just hyperbolic nonsense.
Thanks for the call, Randy. Rich from Rhinelander. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Rich.
Happy New Year.
Happy
to
New
you
Year.
And your guest. I don't mean to be confrontational, but I do want to join my voice with Randy, the previous caller. My background is I taught for 34 years in what is called Wisconsin's Adult Technical College System. And that college system awards wonderful degrees in wonderful fields. Over the years, we had speaker after speaker addressing our students saying, you're going to have to retrain 4, 5, 6 times in your life in order to stay current with the job market. And what I said to my colleagues on the faculty is, some of us are here for 34 years or longer. We're not doing that, but we're telling people in the middle who are not moving into retirement with the kind of health care coverage that I have and they have, that they're just going to have to keep swimming against this tide of outsourcing things overseas. I mean, it's not just manufacturing that's being outsourced. It's accounting jobs, bookkeeping jobs, reading of sort of a recording and reading of certain kinds of medical information and records. And I don't mean to attack your guest, but as an academic of sorts myself, I think there's an arrogance among people. It's not hyperbolic nonsense. I think there's an arrogance among people who are protected, who don't look to people in the middle realistically and recognize what they're suffering in terms of jobs and health coverage, who say that the anger is unfocused and in some ways, by implication, unwarranted. I strongly object to those of us who have the benefits looking at those who do not, our fellow Americans, and saying things like, those jobs are never coming back. We can make those jobs come back if we do understand political science. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Professor Overby.
We can make those jobs come back if we're willing to pay much higher costs, much higher prices for goods and services that we've grown used and accustomed to getting very inexpensively because the labor that goes into them is provided in places where labor costs are much lower. There is no conspiracy out there to make this happen. This is the collective result of the purchasing decisions of the American public in large measure. The kind of jobs that the previous callers have talked about, we could, in fact, do them here. But in the aggregate, that is going to drive up the cost of the cheap computers, the cheap flat-screen TVs, the cheap automobiles, the cheap garments that we as a culture have grown to use and to like a good deal. There are economic and political costs to be paid for this sort of protectionism. And I don't mean to be disparaging toward anyone, but again, in the United States, we have benefited from a number of these economic and political developments. The movement of these jobs overseas has resulted in consumers here being able to pay much lower costs than were paid by our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents for better goods. And the political and the economic cost of that is it's going to displace some people who are doing those jobs that can be performed more efficiently, more cost-effectively overseas.
Thanks, Rich, for your call. Beverly is next. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, how are you? And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to add my voice to the concern that we are moving jobs overseas and the idea that we don't have a group of individuals who are willing to do those jobs or individuals who are willing to buy those products, I think is false. I, as a consumer, always look at to see where a product is made, and I'm much happier buying an American product than a product that's made overseas. But beyond that, I also dispute that we have this educated populace that is willing, and we don't have a group of individuals who cannot do manufacturing jobs. Our education system is virtually broken. I also am an educator. I work both in the elementary, high school, and technical college level. And taught at all three levels. And we have systems where half the kids don't graduate from high school. Where do those people get jobs? They don't. And the though in the short run we may be paying less for a product, the cost for our society in the long run is grave and great. And until we get that fixed, until our education system is fixed, and we actually do have an educated populace, we are in a world of hurt. And sometimes, you know, educators looking from the outside don't really see what's going on the inside because they're not part of it. But take a look at any of the large city education systems, and you can just see how broken our system is and what great need we have for jobs that that don't take a whole lot of education, but and people are willing and need to do. And so I'll take my comment off here.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. And it calls for another whole show on this issue, certainly creation of what kinds of jobs, because we are out of time. Well, Professor Overby, thank you so much for being with us.
You're certainly welcome. I must have done something right because I was attacked from both the left and the right, it seems.
Exactly. That's a sign of a marvelous guest, but you were a great guest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Our guest this hour, Professor Marvin Overby. He is chair and a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our studios here in lovely downtown Milwaukee. Just a reminder that tomorrow during this time period, this guy is a wonderful guest and human being, I might add. Alan Alda will be joining us. He's the host of the PBS series, The Human Spark, which explores why human beings are different. So Alan Alda with us tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll continue with our Tuesday conversation after that news here on the Ideas Network.